Welcome to today's episode of I and with me, your host, On this episode, we have a special guest, Carlos Cuadrado. Carlos is a former Spanish professional tennis player who won the French Open Junior Singles in 2001. Now, for those who are not so into tennis, let it be said that this is an absolutely huge achievement. After a series of injuries and surgeries, Carlos unfortunately retired from tennis early and started working as a coach in Australia. Currently, Carlos is on a quest to sail around the world on his yacht with his partner, Linda. They have a YouTube channel, 22 Souths, which chronicles their adventures at sea. You should check it out. I bumped into Carlos at the Oliver Tambo Airport, or OR Tambo, in Johannesburg on a recent visit to South Africa. It was what one can only call a fortunate stroke of serendipity that we got talking, and they agreed to continue the conversation with you here on I&M. So he had just left his boat there in Richards Bay, South Africa, waiting for them for their next stretch of sailing before going to Australia, where he was when we did this interview in January 2020. It was great fun conversing with Carlos. You can hear for yourself here just how he transcended many an obstacle and how he's finally living the dream.
When I was an athlete, the sport teaches you a lot of commitment and dedication, and I guess a lot of discipline as well, and how to plan things ahead. And I guess I'm using all those skills that I learned before as an athlete now, use them on the boat whenever I have to plan a trip, or the discipline of getting everything of the boat ready to go, or the commitment of, you know, it was a huge commitment to leave everything behind and invest everything I had on a boat and on this trip. So that helped me to face this new project that I'm doing now.
Yeah, it's like it's been a life skill for you. It wasn't just a sport, it's been a life skill.
Yeah, I took those skills from tennis and the sport and put them into sailing. Like, the sport is, you know, the sport is like education. Many people believe about education through the sport and the good values that the sport gives you, and then you can use them in different areas of your life, at work or your personal life or anything you do.
Yeah. You said also that before, tennis was your whole life. It was everything. When did you start your career, and how did you become such a enthusiast of tennis?
Well, you normally start tennis very early, you know. When I started, when I was 5 years old, and then progressively you just, you know, maybe you start competing on the weekends just for fun, but then you get more addicted, and then you want to train more to be able to improve faster, and then you probably go to a little squad in your club, and then slowly you see yourself maybe playing and training every day, maybe like 5-6 days a week. And then slowly you grow and you get more strong, and then you compete more, and everything just grows, no? And then I guess my professional career started when I was 16 or 17, and then it went until I was 25, but the last stage from 20 pretty much until 25, those last 5 years I was injured all the time. So that was tough, and that was the reason I had to retire.
Yes, I know. I heard that you had a number of surgeries and so you still kept on going. Even, I'm sure you didn't have them all at once, did you?
Professional tennis is pretty demanding on the body. Probably maybe my body was not ready to face that level of intensity yet, and I was exposing my body to that, I guess, very often, because I was playing at a good level, and then that meant that I was playing matches that required a high level of physicality for my body, and maybe I wasn't ready for that, but I just kept going because I was winning matches, and then I guess in that time it's difficult to stop. And I didn't know, you know, I didn't know this was going to happen, and maybe managing my career could have been done a bit better. But in any case, the injury started when I was 19. The first surgery was on my knee when I was 19. And after that, I had a surgery every year until 25. So at 20 I had a surgery, at 21 I had another surgery, at 22 another surgery, and like that until 25. And oh, then the main one was my hip. Mm-hmm. So by 25 I had like already like 5 surgeries in my hip, like 2 on my knee, 1 on my wrist. But the one that was giving me more problems was my hip. It seems like my hip was not recovering. And then I was starting to feel a bit afraid that I was not going to have a good hip to walk for the rest of my life. And of course, we have a life after tennis. And then I started feeling a bit scared that, you know, my quality life after tennis was not going to be very good because of that. And it seems like my tennis career was not going anywhere because my body could not handle professional tennis. So I had to make a decision.
Yes. Yeah. You've mentioned so many things that I want to touch on. You know, most kids nowadays, I have kids and kids are so sport oriented, at least in these here parts where I live. And I know that most of the kids, when they think about what they want to do with their future, they often see all these sporting figures and they look up to you guys and they think that this is the way to live your life and you must just focus only on the sport, you know, and not so much on anything academic. What would you say to those children? Because the thing is that, you know, when you're a sporting person, you have to leave room for the possibility that it may end in a wink of an eye or gradually or at some point, right? Or yeah. What helps? What mindset should one have?
Well, it's funny because now I'm currently working in something like that. My current work is working on values with the kids. And I tell them that those role models they see or those idols they see and they wish to be one day like them, this is not who they are. This is what they are doing, you know. Yes. So this is, I think the person comes first and the athletes comes after. So tennis or soccer or rugby or anything, it's what they are doing but not who they are. So there is a life after their career, whatever sport it is. And the kids, I try to have an impact on values from very young age, because after, I believe it's a bit difficult. And I think education through sport. And then I think it's important that the kids understand that in a very young age. And yeah, that would be very positive for their lives in the future.
Yeah, and I think they should also consider possibilities of other professions other than just being a sporting figure or a sports hero, you know, because it's not guaranteed, right? It's not like you're going to stay on top forever and it's going to be there forever. How did you adjust, Carlos, when you had to shift, you know, from being a pro tennis player to being a coach and, you know, to being the Carlos after the tennis play? What was it like for you?
I had a little bit that problem, no? That I had the problem of the I just thought about tennis all my life, and I thought that that was, you know, who I was, and not just what I was doing. And I have to say, like, it took me a few years to adapt to life without being a professional tennis player. I wasn't ready for that. Nobody prepared me for that. And the adjustment and the transition was tough. And actually, I mean, there is a statistic which I don't know exactly the numbers, but it takes a few years for any kind of athlete to try to make the transition into normal life without their professional sport. And I guess now that my work is like try to teach that from young, so that doesn't happen when they finish their careers.
Yes. What helped you in adjusting? What kind of psychological, emotional assistance? Like, what helped you do it? Did you just use willpower, time? What helped you?
I left Spain and I just went very far.
Yeah. You distanced yourself.
Yeah. But, I mean, that shouldn't be that way, you know?
I understand.
That was like a reaction of a problem. So I left Spain and I went to Australia. I went to Australia just to breathe and to restart a life again. First of all, to understand who I was and what did I want to do. And that was very tough to discover. I had no idea. It took me a while. And then I was surfing. Surfing was helping me a lot. You know, it was another sport and connected with the ocean, which I love, as you know.
Yes.
And I guess time helped me to grieve. Grieve, is the word in English?
It is grieve. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have to grieve after you're retired. So you have to grieve, and depends how prepared or how the education that you had on the years you were playing tennis, you grieve for longer or shorter period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that was helped me to go away, but it's not like something I recommend, you know. Like I think the athlete should be ready when the career finishes if they had a proper education from young to understand that when the career finishes, I mean, life goes on, and you know, that's what something they were doing, but not who they are. So that was the main difference.
Yes. I remember the first time you and I met, I asked you, like, did you have like questions of identity? And I think you've just mentioned now that you moved to Australia to discover once again who you were, you know. And when did this new identity come in, and what was it going to be? How did you find your path forward in a different direction, so to speak?
I don't think my answer is the right answer, but this is the truth. Is in my case, I'm still looking for my identity.
Yes.
after 10 years, you know, and yes. I think I'm getting closer, and I think the job I'm doing now of teaching the kids these things, I am applying them to me, and I'm thinking about them as I teach them, and I'm understanding again that tennis was something I was doing, but not who I was. So I think it's been the last days, actually, because I've been going to the Australian Open, and I've been seeing so many friends and ex-players, and now they are coaches, and a lot of people in these events because of my life. No, I spend all my life there. Tennis is a very small world, so we all know each other.
Yes.
So I think I've been understanding a little bit more the last week who, like, the difference between what I was doing and who I am.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a long process. It's a long process.
Do you feel like you've made peace, or are you making peace with things as they are now?
Yes. Yeah. But again, it's funny because it's happening now.
Yes.
It's just happening now.
I catch you at a good time when it's actually happening.
Yeah. Yeah, you could have done this interview in the last 10 years, but no, you're choosing it the week that is happening. I'm finding peace, finally.
You are in the process. I'm in the thick of it with you.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
I think it helped to see. It's interesting, but I think it helped two things. Me working on values, even if it's for somebody else,
yes.
But I'm applying it to me, and me going to the Australian Open and seeing the players again, their life again, go through all that again,
yes.
Because now for a long time, for the last 3 years, I've been in the ocean. No, I've been not contact with the tennis. So, but now that I got in touch again with tennis, it's kind of everything comes back to my mind, and I think I have digested much easier and better than other times. That's why I think now I'm finally making peace.
It's a work in progress, isn't it? It's like progressive.
Yeah.
And I don't think we make peace at once, all at once. I think it's gradual, but you're probably clearer, more clearer now that you've seen yourself in this context, in an old context as the new you, you know?
Yeah.
or the same
also,
you.
it helped also that I saw two good friends, also my ex-coach.
Yes.
And we had this conversation, right? They asked me, how are you doing, you know, with your grief? And they know I've been a bit stuck in the past and getting over the thought about what happened. And then I was telling them that I feel I'm stuck, you know, and that happened like maybe 5-6 days ago. I told them, I think I'm still stuck, you know.
Yes.
I'm in the boat. I dream about tennis. I dream about competing. I felt stuck.
Yes.
And they, you know, through talking to them, I've been, you know, they gave me some directions,
yes.
and they said things and made me think about things that they are helping me very quickly, you know.
Yes.
So, to your question as well, like, what can you do? That's why I said I was not the right example, because I don't think that running away or going far, I mean, it helped in a way, of course.
It
allows you to breathe, but you are not going to solve the problem, right? If you are stuck, you are going to come back and you are stuck. Unless you stay away forever. But then you will always be stuck in a way. Like my dreams, they were taking me back to playing tennis, you know? And that was a real sign for me to be, I was stuck, my mind was stuck. But after talking to them, they give me some guidance.
Guidance, yes.
Some guidance and make me think about other things that then slowly helps. So speaking with somebody that actually knows about this would help, of course. I think that whoever that is, it doesn't necessarily need to be a psychologist or a sports psychologist. It could be a friend. It could be your ex-coach, like in my case. It could be anybody. The other person was as well my ex-boss. I saw my ex-boss, Scott Draper, and he was great with, you know, he's working now in getting people ready as leadership skills. And he works a lot in these things, and he told me about these statistics about the ex-athletes, whatever sport is, it takes a long time to get over it. So he also speaks about this and has a lot of knowledge about how to, you know, accept the situation and move on. So speaking with somebody helps as well.
I think I can see how that could be, because it's liberating. They say that... you know, I know it's a bit extreme. It's going to sound a bit extreme, but they say in order to lay ghosts to rest, you have to call them out by name. And I think when you say it out loud that, you know what, I'm stuck, I feel like I'm still stuck, then that already liberates and creates space for you to actually see it even differently or more clearly, and also to let it go. You know, if that's what you wish, if you want to let go, then speaking about it is probably a very good thing, is a good thing, and it's not just for sports or for tennis or for you, but I think for all of us, if we're dealing with some issue that is that has got us, you know, in its grip, we are stuck in it. I know many sports people who have had their you know, their prime time where they were doing great and amazing things, and then the shift happens and the changes happen, and then they have to have a paradigm shift and then have to start a new way of being, you know. I think it's something that's going to be quite helpful, you know, for most people who are sportly inclined to hear you talk about this. But I want to talk about your high moments. What is it that you miss, that you remember? Those, what were the highest moments of your career that you recall and you remember fondly?
Yes, I remember the day I won French Open Junior.
Yeah.
And that was unexpected, because in Spain, I mean, my budget was not that big in Spain. You know, we have a lot of tournaments, yeah, little professional tournaments. They are called Futures. And then they are very short distance, like driving distance from one to each other. So it's easy to stay in Spain and just play those tournaments. And then it's a good place to develop your game as well. So you don't need to be playing juniors all around Europe, which it costs money of travel and planes, and everything is more expensive outside Spain. Yes. So I didn't have that budget, so it was just easy to stay in Spain, and many other professional players did it this way. So it's a proven way that is a good one. But that means that I was not comparing myself with other juniors, so I had no idea how my level was in the world. And then I just went to play French Open without knowing if I was good or if I was not good. Like, I had no idea. So I surprisingly end up winning the tournament.
Awesome.
And pretty comfortable as well. And then that was a bit of a shock.
And you were 17?
I was 18 by then.
18 by then. And my God.
It was my last year of juniors. And then I was 18, and well, that was a very very high moment, because I was, you know, when you play those tournaments in Spain, like, not many people is watching, you know, it's like, and not many people cares either, you know, it's just very rough, you know, they're very tough tournaments. And then suddenly I go to Paris, to French Open, you know, you have all the superstars playing next to you in the main draw, and then suddenly you win, and you have like hundreds of reporters making pictures of you, and look at here, look at there. Like, I was not used to it at all. I never had that before.
It must have blown your mind, huh?
Yeah, everything was going too fast, right? Too fast to digest. But that was kind of a high moment for sure.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed. And how did that shape the way forward after that high moment? What happened to your career? Like with you, how did you feel? Because now you knew you were good and you knew how good you were.
Yeah. So that helped me too. You know, that gave me a lot of motivation. Yes. And also I felt a bit of a responsibility for the people that was following me. Like I felt like it helped me to keep fighting many matches. You know, I wanted to have a good image. Kids were looking at me, you know, you had more attention. And then when people looks at you, I wanted to look presentable, no? Like good behavior on court and good fighting spirit and these kind of things.
And a good example.
And so that helped me as well.
Yeah, to be a good
example. Yeah, good example for the kids especially.
Yes.
And yes. So trying to be a good role model. And so that helped me and I liked it and I embraced all that responsibility with no problems. Mm. And that was great as well.
I like that. I embraced all that responsibility with no problems. That's a quotable line. I like it. And you traveled extensively. Tell me about your travels, because I think travel was going to play a big role in your life in future. But during your tennis days, you traveled quite a bit. What was that like for you?
I mean, that was like part of the job, no? I guess that I never questioned that. I think if you wanted to be a tennis player, you need to travel every week. And then maybe for 8 months a year. And then that started at a very young age. At 16 already, I was traveling for 7-8 months a year. That helped because that was only in Spain most of the time.
Yes.
But at the same time, you know, you know that the career is how it is. I mean, it's not even a question. I don't think you question that. You know, that's how it is. And when you have no choice, I don't think you think much. You accept it or you don't accept it. But that's part of a tennis career. The traveling, but yeah, it for sure played a big part because it made me very independent and easy to travel. No, like I don't get homesick because I guess traveling at very young age, and probably I liked it, and now it's in my ADN.
it is, and it exposed you. You got exposure to various parts of the world. I mean the way you're talking about travel and tennis, you're talking about it like musicians talk about touring, you know, like on the outside looking in, we're looking at their travels like, oh, how amazing, how glamorous, how wonderful, you know, they go from this place to that place to that place. But for them, the ones on tour and sport people, probably it's like, this is just part of the job. That's how you move from point A to point B.
Yeah,
but surely.
I prefer to travel less, you know, to travel less hours on a plane. But that is just part of how do you get from one place to the next place, to one tournament to the next tournament. And it's how it is. You have to travel the world because the next tournament is somewhere very far. But, you know, people think that what you just said, people think we see every city, you know, is a wonderful life. The travel is great, but we were just seeing the airport, the hotel, and then the tennis club.
Doesn't sound like much sightseeing, does it?
No, because, you know, when you are not training, you don't go to see things because, you know, walking around, it makes you tired, you know, it makes you tired, especially if you are like playing tennis like 5-6 hours a day, you're either training or competing. So go for a walk after 6 hours practice. It's not something that you're looking forward to. So, and when you lose, normally you kind of leave and go to the next place to get the next tournament ready.
I understand. I get it. Musicians say the same thing. They say that you will travel for 24 hours to go and do a 45-minute set, you know, and then back on the plane again. And it's like, what? I had to go so far to go and do this one, like, gig, you know. But it's worth it because it's part of the craft, you know. It's part of your work. It's part of your calling, yeah? Carlos, do you think that you would have gone into coaching even had you not had your injuries, if your career hadn't been prematurely ended, I'll use the word ended, with sensitivity, please understand. Do you think you would have gone into coaching in the end, eventually?
I think yes, in a way. Mm-hmm. I think I would have been connected to tennis somehow.
Yeah.
How, I'm not sure, but maybe not as a full-time coach, but I think for sure as part-time coach, like instead of, you know, traveling the whole year full-time with a player, which is tough as well, maybe doing half of the calendar, or as helping another coach with a player as well, or maybe as a consultant as well, something like that. But I would have been connected to tennis for sure.
Absolutely. And what do you find most rewarding about being a coach?
You help somebody to reach their full potential.
Yes.
And it's very nice if the player wants, you know, is in the same page than you. You know, if you have a player that fights hard, like respects, like somebody that has the same values than you.
Yes.
That is not necessarily easy to find.
You need to find like a good match, somebody who's your match, yeah. So that you guys have the same way of seeing things and you can work together again, with ease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not easy, again, you know, because you cannot...
You can't know. Like
you can just choose. Yeah. It's not going to a shop and just pick, you know, what you want. At the end of the day, it's a job, you know, as well. So you don't always choose. So that's tough.
Then again, it also develops new skills in you when you have to work with somebody who might have a different style of working and different values, because you have to develop another way of working together if that's your job, right?
Yeah, you have to definitely adapt to that player and try to guide him or guide her the way you want, you know, the way you think is going to be more positive for them.
Yeah.
And so a coach is a very, needs to adapt constantly to the, because not two players play the same. So as well, you need to adapt to their game style and try to get the best from that to make them better. And the same happens with their personality.
And for you, as you, Carlos, and as a coach, have you noticed any growth? How have you grown through coaching over the years?
Yeah, I think also it helped me this week making more peace. Like the more peace I make with my past, the better coach I become. I have more patience and I stop seeing myself as a tennis player and I start seeing myself as a tennis coach, which that's been a long process. It's a long process. So I have grow like that. In that aspect, I slowly had more patience and stay more I put myself in the situation of my athlete, you know, think like as if I was him, how would I feel? When before, maybe when I started being a coach, I was just thinking about myself probably.
Mm.
And not necessarily about the player, what they needed, because what I said, everybody is different. So for me, it was like, okay, this is the way or there is no way, you know? And now I guess with the years, I try to find other ways and I understand that's normal and that's probably always going to be like that.
For sure. For sure. And again, it's a work in progress. I mean, it's something that you're continually growing into anyway, you know. And when we were talking a little bit about how you dealt with the changes, you said you relocated to Australia and you were nearer to the sea and you were surfing. Now I want to speak a little bit about your love affair with the ocean. Tell me about it. I mean, currently you have a YouTube channel called 22 South, is it?
Yeah, 22 South, correct.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about 22 South. Tell me about how you transitioned, or not transitioned, how you came into your your love for the ocean and what you're currently doing on the ocean.
Yeah, so my love from the ocean started at a very young age. Mm-hmm. You know, I think as a kid, like one of the highlights, you know, of my life, because I told you one of the highlights of my career, but one of the highlights of my life, I always remember the years we spent as a family with my uncle and the family cousins and my auntie and so in the camping, you know, in Costa Brava, which is like 2 hours from Barcelona, driving towards France. We always went there in the camping, and so it was nature and it was, you know, a lot of sea and beach and a lot of snorkel, and my parents had a little boat, but when I say little means little, like not like inflatable dinghy, where they were going diving, scuba diving with my uncle, And I used to always love that, love going in the boat, you know, getting away. So like traveling from the beach to another beach, you know, in a way, and going to nice places where there is not many people and not accessible by food, and just snorkel there. Or they were going scuba diving. I used to maybe wait for them in the dinghy until they come back, and I was just snorkeling while that was happening. And I was very young, and I was already alone in the ocean doing my own thing, you know.
Yeah.
So I remember those days like one of the best ones of my life.
Mm.
And when I just got older and I was working in tennis, my career finished, so let's say I had more time and I was coaching for 10, 15 years, I felt like I missed that a lot and I need a break. Maybe traveling with the boat one day. It's kind of what I was doing when I was young.
Oh, so it had been a dream of yours to one day do something on the ocean.
Yeah, it's been the ocean. It's been a place where I always enjoy it a lot and brings me back many, many nice memories of moments and family and peace.
Wonderful. Freedom and yes?
Yeah, freedom and peace.
And peace. Yeah. And at some point you decided to buy your own yacht, your own boat. Tell me how that came about.
It was a strange feeling because, you know, every salary was going to my bank account. And once again, and I guess other people maybe would have started thinking long time ago about maybe investing that money, buying an apartment, start moving that money somewhere, you know, because everybody says that money in the bank does nothing, so you have to invest and you have to make more money and all this. But something was stopping me, you know, an instinct was stopping me from buying an apartment, because I quickly realized that if I buy an apartment, I mean, it's not like I can buy an apartment in one day, in one go, and then being that mortgage and to be able to pay that mortgage for the next maybe 20, 25 years. So that was something a bit scary.
Yes.
That was something scary, and then something inside me was stopping me from doing something like that. And then it became the day that I was like, well, okay, let's do something with this money. Now it's enough I have to definitely do something. Okay, let's buy an apartment. But again, it was a feeling that it was not happening. It was just my brain thinking, not my heart feeling.
Yes.
And then I don't know how it happened that I was like, well, if I do this, I'm never going to be able to buy a boat. Or I will be able in maybe 30 years, you know, when I pay this apartment and then I save more money to be able to buy the boat. And I said, like, well, so what if I just buy the boat now? And I just break with all these rules, society rules and expectations from, you know, work, save, buy a house and fill it with kids, you know. What if I just break with that and I just do what I really love?
Wow.
And I was like, okay, looks like maybe it's a mistake for everybody else, but, you know, I'm living my own life and I'm not living anybody else's life. So
yes.
I think it won't be a mistake for me. And if it's a mistake, I accept it. I just go with it.
Wow.
So that's how it happened. I bought the boat, and the day I bought it, I knew it was not a mistake, and that made me very happy. So I knew it was the right choice.
You followed your instinct.
Yeah, absolutely. Took me a while. It's not something that an instinct that comes from one day to another day and you just go for it. No, I'm talking about years of feeling.
Yeah, I mean, nothing really happens. Not many things happen overnight, but especially when it comes to a dream, you know. And when we were talking, by the way, I mean, the listeners are going to discover at some point that you and I met in South Africa just recently when you had been, I think you were leaving your yacht there and we were on our way back to to our respective countries or places of residence. And you were part of the reason you were in South Africa was because you were in your process of sailing around the world.
Yes, correct.
Inspired you to decide you want, not only do you want to sail, but you just want to sail around the world. What inspired that?
I think because, well, the process, it took a little bit of, I mean, no, it didn't take very long, but when I left Melbourne, I didn't just go in a round the world trip. I had it like in the back of my mind. And first of all, was like, okay, let's learn how to sail and let's feel how I feel in the ocean. You know, it's very different to have the memories of my family, you know, Costa Rica when the ocean is flat and it's sunny and it's nice to snorkel, or going in the ocean with a boat, you know, and being, you know, being in charge of it. So I went to try, and slowly after maybe 2 months, I was in around Brisbane, let's say halfway the east coast of Australia, near Sydney. Yeah, I wanted a bigger passage than just hopping from town to town.
Yeah.
And it was the possibility to cross to South Pacific into New Caledonia. So I asked my friend, the guy that was coming with me, about doing it. And yeah, he was happy to come along. And then we just did it. We crossed to New Caledonia. It was a 7 days passage. And then I just loved it. I loved the feeling of being out there at sea and dealing with everything and problem solving and the adrenaline. And that's, I think, why after I decided to sail around the world, because I think coming from a frustrated professional athlete that my career didn't go as far as I was expecting, I still had all that fire inside of me, all that adrenaline. I need that adrenaline and that problem solving moments and that challenge, something difficult to achieve, not train yourself to achieve something that means something to you. That is pretty much a description of any athlete in any sport. So I decided to go around the world because I think that meant something, a big challenge for me. I love the traveling, I love the ocean, and I love the problem solving and everything else that sailing around the world was going to bring. So man, that was how I made the decision. It was more of a need, needed to do something like that, more than a decision. Yeah,
I see what you mean. You said it's a dream within a dream, you know, the traveling around the world is a dream within a dream, because you always wanted to go at sea, and now you are able to even do something greater by traveling around the world. So how far are you, and how much time do you give yourself to do this amazing feat, you know, of traveling around the world on your boat?
So initially I wasn't sure, also because, you know, when you have the time, you don't have the money. When you have the money, you don't have the time.
You are either cash poor and time rich, or time poor or cash rich. Mm. Yes.
Correct. So being young, so I just had time and enough time to save enough to buy the boat. Mm. So the boat was paid, but not the expenses that everything was going to take. So every year, let's say it could cost around 15 to 20... I would say Australian dollars, maybe more, 20 to 30, maybe to 20,000 to 30,000 Australian dollars a year.
Yes.
We are more in the, in the 20 range, because we try to do everything ourselves and save money as much as we can. And so that means that every year you need to have that amount of the budget. And when I left, I definitely didn't have like 80 grand saved or 100 grand, you know, that would have been great, but I didn't, but I left anyway. So
you left anyway, even though you didn't have a safety net, you know, a financial safety net that was there, or a big financial safety net, that is to say. Yeah, you still left anyway. And what did you think? You just thought you're gonna play it by ear and cross the bridges as you get to them and just move forward with your project, with your plan, your dream.
I thought I was going to be able to find a way of making money. And worst case scenario could be to leave the boat in a marina, for example, and go back home and work, or try to find work. So until I have enough money again to keep going.
So you were willing, and you are willing, to do whatever it takes to finance your dream, is what you're saying to me.
Yes. Yeah, correct.
And the name of your boat, I cannot pronounce it. I have looked at it and I have tried. What is the name? How do you pronounce it?
The name is Mirny Ocean. Mm-hmm. Mirny Ocean means Pacific Ocean in Russian.
I see.
And changing the name of the boat, they say, is bad luck. And I also felt like I didn't have the right to change anybody's name. So So I, because, you know, they say, and it's true, the boats have soul. So it's like changing the name of a person, you know, unless the person wants to change their name, it's difficult. It's not, you don't have the right to change it. So I couldn't speak with my boat and ask him if he wants to change his name. In English, they say it's a her, but I think in Spain it's a he, and I think it's a he. I think
really? The boat is his name. You relate to it as a he, yeah. Not as a she.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. You know what's interesting? That what you've just said about changing the name of a boat would be, is like half of the soul of the boat, and it would be like changing the name of a person. In a recent interview that I just did, we were talking about exactly that, about names, you know, and the names that people choose. And I was saying to the person I was interviewing that the name is such a crucial part of who we are, because the soul power resides in the name. And now you're telling me that they talk about this when it comes to boats too. That's like confirmation for me. I never even knew that. Wow. Thank you, Carlos. Thank you. Okay. So you're not intending to change it, the name, his name, because you don't want to get bad luck. And also you don't want to remove part of its soul power. I mean, you don't need to change. If you ever want another, if you want to get another name, get another boat.
Yeah, exactly. But then I have to build, unless I build the boat,
yeah.
I think I will never change the name, you know. If you build the boat, yeah, because you are, you know, you started from scratch.
Yeah.
And then you have built it as you want, and as you, you know, you've built the boat. But if you're buying a secondhand boat, I mean, I know people who has changed it, but that's how I felt in that moment.
Yes.
And that's why I didn't change the name. Yeah.
Yes.
I know it's difficult to pronounce and understand, but it's his name.
That's part of the charm. Maybe that's part of the charm. You know, it is what it is. And tell me about your channel, your YouTube channel, 22 South. How did that come about?
Before, I think I didn't answer your question fully. You asked me about how long I was thinking about to go around the world and all that, and I told you about the working, maybe if I run out of budget, but normally if going fast and around the world trip would take maybe like 3 to 4 years. That is going pretty fast if you follow the trade winds.
Yeah.
Going west. Yeah. The races normally take place going east, because they go to the Southern Ocean when the Roaring Forties, and that's a very rough ocean, but you guarantee you have wind all the time. The races go that way, and it's considered you have to go around all those capes to be considered around the world. What I'm doing more is like cruising, and cruising is more comfortable going west and following the trade winds. With they are a little bit, I mean, they are lighter, but as long as you respect all the seasons as well, from cyclone season in the South Pacific or hurricane season in the Caribbean or etc. Every part of the world has a season that you shouldn't be sailing there.
Mm.
So our trip, I think, totally, I started in May 2017, and I think it could finish if I won in January 2022.
Wow.
But yeah, I think we are on our way a little bit faster than I would like. But at the same time, I feel also I have to go back to work. And it's time to come back to work. And it would have been for me or for us around 3 years and a half, near 4 years around the world trip. And I think that would be a nice break.
Yes.
And I would be happy with that. And because normally people has, let's say, more time. They are retired. People, we see a lot of people retired doing the cruising life. But they have probably a pension as an income, a passive income, or they have rented their home, and then some money kind of coming in somehow. So that helps as well, because this life is not expensive, but if you don't have an income, it becomes expensive unless you have a lot of money saved. And again, because when you're young, chances are you didn't have enough time to save enough money. So, yeah, so everything becomes a bit of a challenge. So, yeah, sorry because I didn't answer your question completely before.
No. You've done a very thorough job at answering it now. How are you keeping it sustainable? How are you keeping it afloat? How are you managing so far, if I may ask?
Yeah, so I run out of all my savings pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the YouTube channel that through Patreon. So patreon.com, you can find us there as 22 South. And it is a membership platform that people join and they pretty much contribute for every video we make. Mm-hmm. And they might have some good things, some prizes, as you know, they have extra videos only for our Patreons, or they have also every year we make a lottery about people coming to meet us on board and sail a little bit wherever we are on the boat. And so we make a little bit of money that way, but honestly not enough, because we don't have enough people yet. Yes. And the other way, out of the blue this year, this job of making the Rafa Nadal Tour events, which is a tournament for under 12 and under 14 kids in Australia. So this tour has been happening for 8 years in Spain, and now they do a partnership with the Australian Federation, the Rafa Nadal brand. And then I am in charge of, and I am part of teaching the values into the kids through off-course activities. So that came out of the blue, and it was great because at the moment we have started with 5 tournaments. 2019 we did 5 tournaments in Australia, and this year we are planning to do more if we can. And those are weeks that I can put in the sailing calendar, and I can, you know, it's generating most of the income right now, and I think thanks to that I'm gonna be able to finish the circumnavigation.
And the beauty is that, you know, your sailing calendar can be put on a break when needs be, or if needs be, right? And then you can come back to it when you are able to come back to it. Is that so?
Yes, that could be so if I stay a whole season in one place.
Yes.
But I'm planning to keep going. So it becomes a bit of a challenge because it means I have less time to move from one place to another place. Let's say now that I'm here, like the boat is in Richards Bay. It was the first port of entry from Madagascar.
Yes. So
I wish the boat was in Cape Town, you know, and ready to go. As for when I come back, that's it. We just go supermarket, buy stock up, you know, and put fuel, and that's it. We leave. But no, the boat is in Richards Bay, which is still a long way until Cape Town, especially rounding that coast is very dangerous, and it can take many days because of the weather changes. And then because I'm here working those two weeks are pretty crucial.
because
then we have to cross the Atlantic as well. It's not only arriving to Cape Town, it's crossing the Atlantic, and then we want to be on our way to the Pacific as well. So that would mean not spending much time in Caribbean, which I am fine now. I was okay by missing a little bit of the Caribbean in that stage. I was more happy to spend more time in the Pacific and in Polynesia.
Yes.
So in this case, it's going to be a little bit of a challenge to put those weeks. If I was, for example, spending another season in South Africa, and then it would have been okay. It would have been no problem.
Yeah.
But because I think it's smart to keep going and making miles, and then it could become a little bit of a challenge in sometimes.
I was going to say, it's like you're challenging yourself, but it is a challenge in and of itself. The very experience, right, is challenging.
Yeah, like I'm dreaming. It's a dream inside a dream, and this is a challenge on top of a challenge.
Trust Carlos to do that. I think it's fantastic. I must say that I'm glad that the boat is in Richards Bay, because had it been in Cape Town, you and I might not have met, because I wouldn't have bumped into you at OR Tambo, would I? Because you probably would have flown from Cape Town.
Yes.
So
correct.
On my side, I can selfishly say, well, you know, thank, you know, God and, you know, for small mercies for letting you be at OR Tambo so we could get to speak. You speak of dangers at sea, and when you told me that you're sailing around the world, I did think to myself, oh my gosh, you must be like, have nerves of steel, you must be super brave, or you must be totally dead devilish, you know. What are the dangers, and are you any of those things? A touch of madness, maybe. You might have a touch of madness.
A touch of madness, exactly. That's a good way of describing it. People keep saying how brave I am, you know, and I don't see myself brave at all. But it looks good. Yeah, it's a good image to have. I'm brave. That's great. It's not how I feel when I'm in the ocean.
How do you feel? How do you feel in the face of all of that unpredictability, that danger that you spoke of? And just, you know, it's, oh my God, it's really, it's a force. Remember I told you what I think of the ocean? It's so powerful. It's a force. It's unpredictable. I'm sure, of course, there are ways to also predict what will happen now that you have an understanding of sailing. You know what I mean? But still, it's like this force that has a power.
No, it is unpredictable. Like, yeah, you go out of the bad seasons and normally you shouldn't get a cyclone or it shouldn't get, super strong winds, but it can still happen, especially how the weather is changing and climate change is affecting all the weather patterns. So it happens. And the way I feel very vulnerable and very humble when I am out there, and I can feel like it's nothing. I mean, there is so little I can do against all the force of the ocean. And when the wind starts blowing and the waves start building, I try to interact with nature and be part of it instead of trying to fight against it. So I have to do something on the boat 100%. I have to just adjust sails or even take sails down, or there is some, but more than that, other than that, there's nothing much I can do after that. You know, it's just the ocean's decision. Whatever it wants to do with the boat, it will do. You know, I have no control. So I can only do a few things, and after that, I can feel like, you know, if the waves are still building and the wind keeps blowing, and yeah, you're a little bit of a mercy of the ocean, of course.
Yes,
and that's why it's dangerous.
Like, and life is in the ocean's hands.
Yeah, I mean, it is like that, but I don't necessarily feel like that all the time. I mean, you know it, okay? That's always there. But it's like taking the car, okay? It's like going driving. You know accidents can happen. It's just like you're not thinking it's going to happen to you right now. You know, it's like you know that you're aware these things happen. And if you lose control of your car, anything can happen. But it's not something that happens every day.
It's not something you're preoccupied with.
Mm. Yeah, no, you're more focused in making sure the boat, you know, you do the right things for that type of navigation, and you make sure you don't have much sail up, and you do the right things, you try to put the waves in the right angle so it becomes less dangerous, so you just interact with the ocean. Normally you would want to put the waves from behind the boat, from the aft, and that makes the whole motion a bit more safe and comfortable. Instead, if you have them from 90 degrees from beam bridge. But other than that, just try to, just hang in there, pretty much.
Hope for the best.
Yeah, hope for the best and stay focused, you know, I guess. I guess that's the part I like, you know. It's like the one that connects me with my past, being focused in doing something and have the nerves, the pressure, the responsibility of having to perform under pressure. And I guess I like that feeling when everything, you know, you have overcome that challenge, you feeling of achievement. It's nice.
It's a reward in and of itself. I see when I've been watching your videos, I can see just how it's exciting. I mean, prior to meeting you, I didn't spend over much time watching sailing videos. I probably didn't spend much time thinking about sailing, but from having watched 22 South, I find myself like following, you know, what you're doing and how you're doing it and the places you guys go to and the stuff you see and the challenges you meet. And you told me that you had to teach or learn. You had to actually go and learn or teach yourself as you go as well about sailing. How much time did you dedicate towards that learning? Because it looks to me like you're doing your learning at sea as you go.
Yeah. I did a few courses in LEN. I did like two or three courses up to coastal, RYA course, coastal skipper. And then I did a diesel course, but you know, diesel course is 2 days. And then, I mean, I feel like it doesn't matter how many courses you do, you will get the theory for sure. And that was great to have, you know, the basics of anchoring, the basics how to reef the mainsail and the basics of this and that. And but at the end of the day, it's good to have the theory, but you have to go there and practice. And the only way of practice is doing it. Like, it's not like you can pay a private teacher for you and go and teach you. You know, it just takes too many hours. Like, you have to go and do it yourself, and hope to don't die in the process.
Yeah, but it's super serious. I mean, we're laughing about it, but that's super serious, right? Yeah, I guess you don't die in the process.
Yeah. I guess it helps if you have done it when you're a kid. You know, you learn how to sail when you're a kid, and then it just becomes progressively, you just keep building. But if you didn't have that background like me, and then you have to make a choice, you know, spend years building that knowledge, because it would take years, or just, you know, take the basics and use a lot of common sense, try to be always in the safe side and don't do anything stupid, and go as you feel, but you have to go out there and do it yourself. Because one day has to be the first day, right? So it depends how long you're gonna wait until that day. And then I just decided, that's why I brought my friend Ben with me. He was a great sailor, and he was making me do everything, because he knew, you know, after 1 month I was going to be alone. But I felt safe with him on board, because I knew if I do anything wrong, or I was asking, you know, for his approval. I was saying, Ben, I think we need to do this. What do you think? You know, it's the right thing to do. So I was always, I felt safe with him. But I also felt that I was not learning much either, because you are in the safe side by having somebody making the last call for you.
Yes.
And then I felt like I really learned the day he left, and I was alone in the boat. And even if I was already for 1 or 2 months on board, every day I felt like, again, like naked. You know, I felt like, okay, now I'm alone. And now I feel like I know nothing again, you know. And that's when I learned very fast. That's when I sailed alone to Vanuatu. Yes. From New Caledonia to Vanuatu, and I learned super fast in that process, that I had nobody else on board, and I was double checking or triple checking everything, thinking at night, thinking all the time, to make sure I don't make a mistake, because a mistake could cause you too much.
Yes.
So I learned there a lot, and then after maybe a year, I start feeling like much more comfortable and much more like ready to cross the Indian Ocean, for example.
Oh my goodness. To me, it sounds like from this experience of sailing, it is whatever it is that you learn at sea, it's definitely going to be applicable in your everyday life hereafter, or even probably now you already see. Do you see any changes, any differences in how you view the world? Tell me about it.
Yes. The ocean transforms you, for sure. The fact that you are in touch with nature every single day, it makes you, you know, I guess it affects people differently, but it makes you be, you come back to society and makes you be aware of, you know, the big problem and the big damage we are making to the world. And it's something that in the city is probably difficult to think about, because I don't think that society is doing a very good job about making everybody aware about how much damage we are making to the planet. So when you're out there and you see all these beaches full of plastic, and, you know, 1 second you are snorkeling with a turtle, having an incredible experience, and then next second you are in the beach with full of plastic, that, you know, in a deserted island. I'm talking about nobody lives in that island or in that atoll, and it's full of plastic. And then you know where that plastic comes from. It definitely didn't come from the turtle you just saw 2 minutes ago.
No.
So, but it's affecting them, you know, and they are not they're not to blame. And then you feel responsible, and then you start reading labels of the bottles, and they come from everywhere. They could come, you know, in that case, we're in an atoll in the middle of the Indian Ocean. So with the trade winds, everything was getting blown from Indonesia, from Asia, pretty much. So you would have from Asia and India and everywhere from the East Coast. No? So you have labels of bottles from Sri Lanka, or bottles from Thailand, bottles from Malaysia, bottles from Indonesia. Like, you could read, you could find all of them.
Oh,
and that's sad. And then, but then you're aware when you come back in society and you go to the airport and you ask, you know, you're in a normal restaurant, when I was there in one of my flights, asking for a meal. And they serve me in a plastic plate with plastic cutlery. And I asked, can I just have a normal plate that you will have? Yeah, you will have to clean after. But it's not a use and throw. You know, this plastic thing, you will throw it, and but that will go somewhere, and somewhere I know where it goes, because recycling is not that easy. Recycling, you know, there is so many different types of plastic, so it's not like they can put everything in a machine and it comes in, it goes out, everything recyclable again. There are plastic bags, and there are different materials, and there are straws, and there are cup bottles, and there are bottles, and every kind of plastic is different. And plastic is extremely resilient material, so it lasts forever. It's a big problem, and we are generating much more plastic that we are getting rid of, and that's horrible. It is horrible. So it changed you in that way a little bit, I think, makes you more aware.
It makes you more aware, but also it probably heightens the sense of responsibility, and I would feel guilty. I mean, not guilty, but bad if I had to come into contact with that much amount of pollution. And now maybe that's part of your destiny. Maybe you're supposed to raise awareness around this issue. I mean, you are now doing it right now, I know. But maybe that's also what needs to be done. We need to raise more awareness around climate, environmental friendliness, and the way we treat the planet, right?
Yes, definitely. But I also feel, you know, you go back to the cities, and it's a huge lack of direction. Like, it's difficult to know what to do. It's difficult to know what's really happening. There's a lot of misinformation. And obviously the media, there are so many interests, like, because there are so many companies that they just try to make money regardless of anything else. So there are some other companies, of course, a company is a business. I mean, we all have to pay the bills, you know, at the end of the month, so we need to make money. But there are some companies that they are just ruthless about making the money, and there are other companies that just try to make money at the same time that they do something good for the planet. And I guess that's how it should be, and that idea should be reinforced by governments and give much more guidance to people in what to do exactly, because I don't think there's enough information out there to know exactly what's good and what's bad and what to do and what to not.
Yeah, so, and that's a big one. And you're correct when you say that it is easy to ignore the problem when you don't come into contact with it. So when you don't go snorkeling and come across plastic every day or every time you go, you don't have the sense of responsibility as you would have, because you are there in contact with nature and with the ocean.
And because there is not enough information. I'm here in the city, and I'm again, it's nothing was happening. You know, there is not enough information that we can easily, I mean, we can all reach internet, but I think the problem is much bigger. So information should be out there much more, much more.
I agree.
And law, much more strict laws to reinforce doing something for the planet. And it's not. That all that is a very slow process. Like, the damaging the planet is going a much faster speed than the efforts that the governments are doing to reduce the impact in the planet. You know, so we are losing the race by far.
Oh my goodness, Carlos, we are. I my heart goes out to the planet, and one can only hope that there's going to be something that is going to force us into making the necessary changes. But I think the planet is already showing us in different ways how it's suffering, and at some point or another, we're going to have to stop and wake up and do something. I hope the day comes sooner than later. You had said to me that I think when we were chatting one of these days, you said that your relationship with the ocean kind of has deepened or changed. Like, you even find yourself talking to the ocean. Tell me a little bit more. Elaborate on that one.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I speak to the ocean a lot. it's difficult maybe to explain. I don't know. The ocean is so powerful, knowing when you are living on top of the ocean, literally every day. Now you start building a relationship with the ocean. It also is the fact that my uncle passed away exactly 1 year ago, last year in January, 13th of January, and we throw the the ashes into the ocean as well. Yeah. And so I speak to him as well. I know now he's part of the ocean.
Yes.
And that made the relationship even bigger that I had already with the ocean.
And that is deep.
So I don't know, you do a lot with the ocean. I mean, to eat, I need the ocean. To, you know, when we snorkel or we want to see nice things, I need the ocean. To travel, I need the ocean. For many things.
To survive.
Yeah.
To survive, you need the ocean to be on your side.
I'm fishing more than ever now. And to do what I do, I would only be able to do it if there is ocean.
Yes. So you better keep talking to that ocean.
Yeah, I wish.
I'm making jest, but I'm serious. You know that it's a relationship worth nurturing because you are a part of it. You know, you are part. You're living on the ocean. So why not be connected? You know,
you feel the energy. I mean, you become connected because you feel the energy of the ocean.
Yes.
You know, you don't know, you cannot explain it, you don't know exactly what it is, you can just feel it. You know, all those nights that I'm sailing and everything is dark, and you know, we have these two different type of night sailing. When it's totally dark and then you see the stars super bright, and then you know you are sailing the ocean, let's say in that moment, you know, it's a good sailing, I don't have to be so focused, maybe it's calm and we're sailing along very nice. And it's dark, and then you're alone in the cockpit, totally alone. It's like a super spiritual experience itself,
yes.
You know?
Yes.
And you only hear the ocean, you know, because when you're sailing, there is no engine. You only hear the waves hitting the ocean. It's a beautiful sound.
Priceless.
And you don't see anything else. It's like when you are meditating that you close your eyes.
Yes.
So it's the same. You just maybe see the stars, and it's just extremely, that's
vast.
How you get connected to nature. It's impossible to not be connected to nature.
Oh my God, under these circumstances, I can see how impossible it would be not to get connected. And it is like a spiritual practice. I think even the sense of solitude, like you're talking about being alone there, it probably does a lot. And just hearing the ocean is healing and soothing, even when you are on shore, you know, when you are sitting on land and just listening and contemplating. So how much more when you are at sea and then you've got that vastness, that spaciousness. I can see, to me, it feels like talking to you about it now feels like it is a spiritual experience, you know, and nature is powerful. We've talked about this. What is in the cards? What next? You're in Australia still. You've got a few more days left. Tell me, what is your next step?
I'm flying today. Here is that's a good question. What day is today? Wednesday.
Is it already Wednesday for you? For me it's Tuesday.
So I am flying on Friday back to Richards Bay, back to South Africa.
Okay.
And I have like two or three projects to finish with the boat. I would say it would take me 10 days, 2 weeks. After that, it's sailing time again and trying to reach Cape Town as quick as possible. And then trying to reach Caribbean after that, hopefully be in the Caribbean by April.
Yes.
And then crossing the Panama Canal May or June, something like that. That would be the plan.
Yeah, and to follow the travels and your route, we need just watch your YouTube channel, 22 South, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We have a YouTube channel and our Instagram is the same, 22 South, and also Carlos 22 South, because we have a bit more pictures there because I started that account a bit before. Like I met Linda in the middle of the trip. When I went to New Caledonia, so I have some extra pictures in my account, but both accounts are good, and Facebook page as well. But so we have all everywhere in social media and the YouTube channel. Yeah.
That was Carlos Cuadrado, a truly remarkable human being. And to find out more about their travels, you can find them on their 22 South YouTube channel.
And follow us on Instagram and Facebook at I&Arm Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube. There are some videos there now, and in future, we'll have some special episodes that have also been filmed. One of them has already been done, but let's not get ahead of ourselves just yet. Do subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts from, so you don't always have to go and look the new episodes up from the website. We are on Spotify, Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and pretty much everywhere. So whatever works for you, we're probably there. If you want to do that, you can also access us on our website at www.iandarm.com. The next episode is coming in 2 weeks' time, and we shall have an amazing guest then from South Africa, singer-songwriter Bongeziwe Mabandla. But until then, cheerio.